How did one of the world's most famous atheists become one of its most famous Christians? Find out in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. It's written by regular guest Dr. Joel Heck. From Atheism to Christianity is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. From Atheism to Christianity.
Secularism is the dominant religion in America, and I would say more specifically, secular progressivism is the dominant religion in many American institutions.
I have often said that the term adiaphron has become, in many instances, among us Lutherans, the theological escape hatch.
If you want to know what it means to be a man, if you want a perfect picture of masculinity, get yourself a crucifix, because the cross is the most masculine thing that has ever happened.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
Are the most basic claims of evolution and its broader worldview, naturalism, are those most basic claims in fact true? How much does evolutionary theory depend on not so much scientific findings or observation, but on speculation? And is it true that an evolutionist really is required by that worldview of naturalism to assert that despite all appearances, life evolved entirely, not just mostly, not just almost completely, but entirely by chance? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be hearing Dr. David Menton talking about creation and naturalism, contrasting these two worldviews on this Wednesday afternoon. In hour two of Issues Etc., Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard joins us to talk about two issues: President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and the House passage of a health care bill. We'll round off today's Issues Etc. talking with Dr. Danny Faulkner of Answers in Genesis about the Vatican attempting to affirm both creation and the Big Bang. Let's start with Dr. David Menton's presentation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Dr. David Menton is a regular guest speaker for Answers in Genesis and Associate Professor Emeritus at Washington University in St. Louis. Here's his presentation, Making the Case for Creation.
Thank you very kindly. First of all, I want to thank Pastor Mike Walter for going through all this trouble to put up the screen. I just found out a couple of weeks ago that we weren't supposed to use any kind of visuals. I can't even give you my name and address without a visual. So I said, you may not have time to put together just a straight verbal lecture for you. And they said, we'll take care of it. We'll put up a screen. And all this work, I just really appreciate it. Way beyond the call of duty. I also want to thank Todd for giving me the opportunity to follow not just one, but two lectures by Professor Paul Mayer. Big shoes to fill there. In fact, for me to do that, it's going to require a great deal of chutzpah on my part. You familiar with the word chutzpah? Yeah, it's a Jewish word for presumption, extreme presumption. Really a Yiddish word. In fact, the best example I've heard of chutzpah is that exhibited by a young man who, after just killing both his mother and father, appealed to the leniency of the court by reason of the fact that he was an orphan. That would be chutzpah. I'll be exhibiting just a little bit of that here, I guess. Well, we're going to ask the question, is evolution compatible with biblical Christianity? The answer is no, and that's pretty much what I had to say. I'll open for questions, if you have any. Expecting a little more than that, I see, so I'll press on. I think before we start dealing with, what's compatible with what, we ought to define our terms, and let's define evolution. And who better than the National Association for Biology Teachers could define evolution for us? This is from their 1995 statement. They have more recent statements that are longer, but they say the same thing. And that is that evolution can be defined this way: the diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution, an unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, and natural process of temporal descent with genetic modification that's affected by natural selection, chance, historical contingencies, and changing environments. That's kind of a complicated definition. Julian Huxley, who's considered the dean of American evolution, now deceased, gave the keynote lecture for the 100th anniversary of celebrating publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. This was at the University of Chicago, and he summed up evolution this way. He says, our present knowledge indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. Wow, the whole of reality, that'd be pretty much everything, wouldn't it? And you know there's different kinds of evolution. There's biological evolution, which I'll be dealing with largely. There's geological evolution, that the Earth has evolved over 4.5 billion years. And then there's cosmological evolution, that the cosmologists talk about, or as my wife puts it, the cosmetologists. And they believe that the cosmos is about 12 to 14 billion years old, give or take a week or two, I guess, one way or another. I'll be focusing largely on biological evolution, but the three are related, and all three are considered to be, by evolutionists, the whole of reality. You know, when we use those terms, the whole of reality, we're really not talking about science anymore. We're talking about a philosophy of science, one known as scientism. Yeah, this is a real word. You can look it up in the dictionary. Basically, scientism is the worldview based on the assumption that everything that is real is material. So if God were to exist, he could conceivably be the most interesting thing in the universe, but he would just be part of the universe. He too would be matter, energy, time, and space. So this worldview is, as I say, matter, energy, time, and space is the whole show. There's nothing else. Well, what are the different evolutionist positions? There's actually several. I'm just going to divide up into two camps so we can kind of see that evolutionists themselves take a little different view. There's what we call atheistic evolution, and that indicates or would argue that the origin of life in all things is purely naturalistic and does not involve the divine in any way. That, quite simply, is the evolution of the professional evolutionist. There is another type of evolution called theistic evolution. You'll hear about that. The beliefs are basically similar. On the surface, they're hard to tell apart. The origin of life in all things is essentially a naturalistic process, but does involve at least a divine presence, if not intervention. It's very difficult, usually, to get a theistic evolutionist to define precisely what role God plays in evolution. In fact, you get to the end of a movie, if you notice, there's all these credits, and there's this one guy called The Grip. I've never known what The Grip does, but he always gets his credit at the end. You know, The Grip is here. I kind of think maybe to the theistic evolutionist, God might be the grip. Well, then there are us creationists. We too fall into, I guess, two camps. There's other divisions, but this would be the main one. What I would call biblical creation is God created all things in six literal days by the power of his word and Holy Spirit. And those would be ordinary days, not some figurative concept of a day, each characterized as having a sunrise and sunset. Normally, we don't go to those great lengths when we talk about days. People understand what we mean, particularly when we say first day, second day, third day. But God knew people would not want to believe this. And so he really beat a dead horse, I think, when he added, and oh, by the way, these days had mornings and evenings. If you want to get away from a day after that, you really have to do violence to Scripture. Sorry about that. Then there's the progressive creationists. These are creationists. They're not evolutionists. They don't believe that evolution explains things. But they believe in the geological time scale. So typically they believe in geological evolution, but not biological evolution. And they believe that God created progressively over millions of years. God created something, waited a million years or so, created something else, waited, created something else, and waited. I call it created and waited evolution or creation. We'll get into some of the specifics of that. It might be worthwhile to think or consider how many people are in each camp. The Gallup Poll Organization has been doing surveys for 32 years, actually 33 now, but I have data for 32 here. And they've asked people this very question, whether they were taking a theistic evolution, atheistic, or special creation view. Back in 1982, 38% had the theistic evolutionary view, and in 2014, 31% have had indicate that point of view. Atheistic evolution was 9% back in 1982, and it's 19% today for atheistic evolution. Special creation seems to have held its own over the years. Think of it, 32 years, and it's bobbled around the low 40% range, 44%, 42% at the moment. What can we conclude from this? It would appear that over the years, the number of people who believe in theistic evolution have gone down statistically, and it would almost appear as if that group has added to that group which has become atheistic evolutionists. I believe that is the natural progression of theistic evolution to atheistic evolutionism. We'll discuss that more as we go along. What are the reasons why Christians might compromise with evolution? Well, there's two obvious ones. One is that the scientific evidence absolutely demands it. No matter what it does to Scripture, you're just simply going to have to stretch, bend, or do whatever is necessary because we're dealing with facts. You can't contradict them. We just have to bow to science. Another possibility is that evolution is completely compatible with Christianity. Indeed, some might argue the Bible actually teaches it, although I doubt very many people have become evolutionists by reading the Bible, no more likely than you become a Jehovah's Witness by reading the Bible. I'm going to be going down this list. This is kind of the essence of my talk. If you're going to fall asleep on me, you can just see the whole thing right here. This is just a brief list of what I feel are just fundamental differences between the creation view and the evolutionary view. Let's start with the first one, intelligent design. As a creationist, I believe that, for example, the eye shows intelligent design. That falls in a scientific category we call duh. Evolution says they hate the word intelligent design. In fact, a lot of teachers have lost their job teaching biology by teaching intelligent design. Just before I left St. Louis, one of the local high schools there in St. Louis County, asked me to give a lecture to the advanced biology students on the placenta. And we had an administrator show up with his clipboard. He said he was on the Committee for Evolution. He had heard that I was a creationist. And he sternly warned me not to teach intelligent design in my lecture of the placenta. I assured him that I had no idea how to design a placenta and would not be telling the students how to do so either. But I said, I'm going to give the best, most insightful lecture I can give. And what if, God forbid, some of the students were to conclude that there's an intelligent design in the placenta? Would that be my fault? And I won't use the word intelligent design. He didn't know what to make of that. In fact, I'm not sure he even followed the lecture, but the students did very well.
We're listening to Dr. David Menton making the case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference on this Wednesday, May the 10th. Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Biology at Washington University in St. Louis. More from his presentation at the Making the Case conference when we come back.
The Reformation was an attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of life then, and those questions endure today.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Who is God? Who am I? Where is God found? What does God make of us? Who is Christ? What's the purpose of my life? Why does suffering happen? All those questions remain absolutely pertinent, and the answers that were given in the Reformation are absolutely relevant today.
You can meet and hear Pastor Matt Harrison making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, call 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Dr. David Menton's case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. For the break, he was talking about evolution and talking about intelligent design. Now he goes on to discuss evolution's dependence on chance.
Do evolutionists really invoke just blind, purposeless, mind, goalless chance? Absolutely. Several years ago, I visited the Field Museum of Natural History, one of America's premier natural history museums. And to emphasize the role of chance, they incorporated a little gambling casino into the museum. I watched these two kids go through. You see in the right up here, I kind of think they're brother and sister. I call them Tommy and Sally. They stopped off first in the image on the left there. That's what they call a dice layout. They have these in gambling casinos, I've been told. They were throwing a dice and just having a ball. I'm glad a lot of young kids don't read anymore, because over the top was a sign that says, "Is life just a game of craps?" Ooh, that's a pretty heavy philosophical hit for kids this age, huh? Parents drop them off at the museum to be entertained, and if by some outside chance possibly even educated, they walk up to an exhibit, and it's sort of like this. Tommy, your sister Sally there, is she just one big game of craps? Is she just pure chance? I mean, your mother, your father, your whole existence, your Christianity, everything, is it all one big game of chance? Wonder if the parents prepared them for this. Wonder if the pastor gave them a little heads up. Maybe aunt, uncle, grandpa, grandmother took the kids aside and said, Tommy and Sally, someday somebody's going to come up, look you right in the eye and say, is your whole existence just chance? You need to be ready to deal with this. Are your kids ready, your grandkids, whatever, to deal with a challenge like this? Well, you know, we say it's obvious that they're designed in nature, and yet many evolutionists deny it, and yet some seem to have trouble denying it. Good example is Richard Dawkins. How many have heard of Richard Dawkins? Yeah, he was a professor at Oxford. He hit mandatory retirement age, and now he's becoming a millionaire, just writing the most outrageous atheistic diatribes imaginable. He's written several books, and one, he suggested that any parent that raises their children to be a Christian is actually engaging in child abuse, especially creation. By that, he meant that poor kid would be so dumbed down he couldn't hold any kind of a job or whatever. I'll give you an interesting statistic about Dr. Dawkins. They say this man knows more things that aren't true than perhaps anyone alive. It's an interesting, interesting thing. He wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker, and the subtitle of that book, you can read, it's basically the title of the slide, Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. Got the picture? Here's a whole book that's showing you that the evidence reveals a whole universe with no trace of design. I don't know how you're going to explain this sentence, but it appears in page one of the book. That would be the first page. I think God came down, grabbed him by the ears, and said, Richard, this is what you're going to write on the first page of your book. Don't change a word, or we're going to split your book in two with lightning. How else are you going to explain that on the first page of this book that's supposed to show a universe without design, Dawkins said this, and I quote, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. If I were writing a book that argued there's no design in the whole universe, and I actually believed this, I wouldn't put it on the first page. I'd squirrel it away on page 280, possibly in a footnote. I agree with Dr. Dawkins. Well, I'll tell you, biological systems, overwhelming. In fact, he sees it himself, so how can he be sure there's no designer, even though they look designed? He can be sure because there's two things he's absolutely certain of. Two things that are absolute truth to him. The first absolute truth is there are no absolute truths. Think that one through for a while. And the second absolute truth is the only thing that exists is matter, energy, time, and space. There's no God, there's no creator. So I could care less how designed things look. Nature somehow counterfeits design because we know there's no designer. In fact, any designer up to the task of designing, say, the human body would have to be nothing less than God himself. And if you're certain there's no God, you've solved the problem. In fact, when I think about it, the very best evidence for evolution for these people is two words. How else? There's no other way. There's matter, energy, time, and space, and if we have people, nature must do this stuff. Well, yes, biological systems look designed. In fact, we usually can recognize design when we see it. Here's a very simple design. It's a type of truss known as a Warren's truss. You see it, example, in this bridge going across the creek here. Most buildings, like at the Creation Museum, the trusses that support the roof are this type. They'll be familiar to you. It's sort of like a series of triangles between two parallel bars. And it's said to be the strongest truss that can be made for a given amount of material. Did I tell you there was going to be an exam? Oh yeah, we teachers don't get paid a whole lot. One of the few joys we have in life is persecuting students with exams. My exam question is this. Since you're pretty sure the Warren's Truss was designed, who designed the Warren's Truss? You might think Warren, wouldn't you? I love failing students. Let me just give you an example of this that's interesting. You take a vulture, not one of the prettiest birds, and you look at the metacarpal bone. That's these bones that are in the palm here. You slice them down the middle and look inside, and guess what you see? Not Warren's Truss, God's Truss. I believe God designed the Warren's Truss. Oh, I could give you a lot of examples of things I've worked with over the years. Here's a picture I took several years ago of a bird feather. You can see the shaft running down the middle, the vein on each side, the barbs that go out at an angle. And each of the barbs has little tiny barbs called barbules, and they crisscross like crisscrossing fingers. And they're hooked together by basically Velcro. Only God's Velcro is in a totally different league than man's Velcro. Let me show it to you. At higher power, you can see these little hooks. And the what we call the anterior barbels that point more towards the tip of the feather, they crisscross with the posterior. They grab a little groove that is on the posterior barbel right in here. It looks like a celery stick. And the radius of curvature of the lip of that groove precisely matches the hook. The dimensions of the hook have to be such that when it comes forward, it grips that groove. The hook needs to have a hinge. The hinge must be designed so the hook doesn't go left and right, only back and forth. And here's a picture of these marvelous hooks in position. Hooking the grooves in the posterior barbel, you can see a little guide probe that guides the hook in. Here's the hinge. The hinge turns out to be a strap hinge. That's a perfect choice. It's like this. It bends this way, but not left and right. I got a question for you. How's dumb luck working for you on a feather? We're talking something simple like a feather. You can imagine if we get into something really complicated like, say, a hair. Back to our chart. What about complexity? We're talking about more than complexity. The word complexity simply means you sure got a lot of parts in this thing. A shuffle deck of cards is complex. It's 52 cards that could be arranged in 52 factorial ways. That's about 1 times 10 to what, the 40 or 50th power. A lot of different combinations, and no combination is any more likely than any other, including a straight bridge hand. Evolutionists say that complexity increases over time. By that, we mean integrated complexity. That's when the parts work together. It's not enough to, if you had all the parts of a Boeing 747, I think there's 2 or 3 million parts in it, Boeing 747, I looked it up once, you couldn't fly the parts. But if you had the specifications of how to assemble them, we call that specified complexity, and then you assemble the parts, we call that integrated complexity, you could fly that. Well, what about that? Does complexity of that type, integrated complexity, decrease or increase? Here again, the Dean of American Evolution, Julian Huxley, says about evolution, nowhere in all of its vast extent is there any trace of purpose or even perspective significance. He said evolution is impelled from behind by blind physical forces, that it's a gigantic and chaotic jazz dance of the particles and radiations. Wow, once again, I think God came down. Got a hold of him by the old cheeks and said, Julian, you're going to finish this sentence the way I tell you to. How else are you going to explain that he finishes his sentence? Remember, he's just said that evolution is no trace of purpose, it's blind physical forces, it's a jazz dance of the particles, in which the only, do you see the word only, in which the only overall tendency we've so far been able to detect is that summarized by the second law of thermodynamics, the tendency to run where? Down. Now let me tell you, if you're going from the Big Bang, and if you like the Big Bang, enjoy it, because it's going out of fashion. It will soon be replaced. There's too many things working against it right now, scientifically.
We're listening to David Menton's presentation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Making the Case for Creation. We are exactly 30 days away from our fifth annual Making the Case Conference, Friday, June the 9th, and Saturday, June the 10th, in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Registration for the conference is $120 and includes three meals. Child care is $40 for children ages 1 through 12 and also includes the meals. We've got a great lineup. Chris Roseborough, Matt Harrison, Terry Mattingly, Aaron Wolf, Peter Bender, and Todd Peppercorn. Pastor Will Whedon will be leading us in a hymn study, and Pastors Jonathan Fisk and Ted Giese will join us for a live remote broadcast to kick off the conference. Attendance is limited to 400. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. That's Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write Summer Conference in the memo line of your check. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Well, he's brought up the subject of the Big Bang. We'll talk a little bit more about that on the other side of the break as we listen to Dr. David Menton, Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis, making the case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Parents, you know the church is persecuted, even when you don't feel it or see it. But how can you prepare your children for a post-Christian world where that persecution is increasingly obvious? Read the May issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about catechesis, persecution, and why it's your job, not your pastor's, to train your children in the faith. Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer, $6.99 for six digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Moline, Illinois, invites you to join us in receiving the Lord's gifts in word and sacrament. Sunday services are at 8:15 and 10:45 a.m., with Bible class and Sunday school at 9:30 a.m. We are located in the Quad Cities at 4107 21st Avenue, Moline, Illinois. Welcome in the name of our Lord.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us.
doxology.us.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A new seminary student spends more than $300 on Greek textbooks. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, wants to reduce this financial burden with the Logos Project. Our goal is to raise funds to provide each of our new pastoral ministry students with the resources they need to begin their study. The Logos Project runs through May 19th. Learn more at generosity.ctsfw.edu. Help future pastors begin their journey with the Word of God. generosity.ctsfw.edu.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Dr. David Menton's presentation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for creation. Now, before the break, he was talking about the Big Bang Theory, that Big Bang Theory. Warnings, of course, that if you're still hanging on to that one, it might slip through your fingers. It's going out of scientific fashion. Here he picks up with more on the Big Bang.
But if you're going from the Big Bang, which is an expanding cloud of hydrogen in over 14 billion years, you're heading on your way to, say, Albert Einstein, you have to go uphill a little bit, huh? From hydrogen to Einstein, you have to go uphill a little bit. And yet, the only general direction, he says, is downhill. That's true. That's the law of thermodynamics he's talking about, the second law, to be exact. And Sir Arthur Eddington, the distinguished astronomer, said that if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. So why hasn't it collapsed? I believe because Satan's behind it. That's why it hasn't collapsed. The Bible says man suppresses the truth in unrighteousness. It doesn't say he doesn't know it when it comes to the evidence of God's handiwork in nature. He suppresses the evidence he sees. Well, back to our table of differences between creation and evolution. The third example I give is how we view the variation that we do observe among individuals of a species. Creationists say this variation is limited. Evolutionists say not only is it unlimited, it's not mere variation, it's transformation. You transform one creature in another. After all, we're supposed to have gone from, what, bacteria to humans. That took a lot of transformation, not just variation within kind. What do we actually see in nature? There are really three models of what we could call speciation, how you come to have new organisms. One is called stasis. That means there is nothing new. Nothing changes. Everything's static. I kind of call it the grass theory. Looks like a bunch of blades of grass. Organisms start out in the past at some point in creation and haven't changed until today. Believe me, that's not observed. In fact, we know that's not true. There is variation among the individuals of a species. Evolutionists basically take this view, often called macroevolution or molecules to man evolution or amoeba to man evolution. And it's that typical tree. Darwin drew a tree. In fact, it was the only illustration in his entire book, Origin of Species, was a tree like this, over which he wrote, I think. In this view, one form of life, some might say a few, that evolved by spontaneous means, branched out to form everything we have today. We do not observe this. We do not observe stasis, and we do not observe in nature macroevolution. What do we actually observe again and again? Something like this. Yes, there is variation within the individuals of a species, but it's limited. It's very limited. It's more limited in some creatures than others. Some creatures are monospecific. They're just one species and that's it. We humans are an example of that. How many species of humans do you know? One, Homo sapiens. How many subspecies of humans? One, Homo sapiens subspecies sapiens. How many races of humans are currently recognized by the scientific community? One. It's called the human race. There's not enough differences among people to even divide them up into races. I hope the federal government learns this soon, because I filled out a form for a gun in which I had to indicate which of five or six different races I was. I was afraid if I put in human, I wouldn't get my shotgun. I don't think they trust humans. This is probably one of the most famous examples of evolution in action you're ever going to find. It's the peppered moth. You've all heard of it, I'm sure. A fellow by the name of, I believe, Kittlewell came up with this. And basically, in England during the Industrial Revolution, pollutants from the Industrial Revolution caused the lichens that grew on certain trees to die and become black. And the peppered moths, I hope this doesn't come as a huge shock to you, but they're sort of like people. They can be lighter or darker. And when the trees became dark, it seemed like more of the dark ones prevailed than the light ones. And the argument was the birds could see the light ones, they ate those and not the dark ones. Then when the air is cleaned up, presumably everything goes back again. Now you can't see the light one, which is circled on the right up there. You can see the dark. There's really no evidence that this actually explains the relative proportions of light and dark moths. In fact, the evidence indicates the moths really don't rest on trees. They rest on the leaves up in the crown of the trees. They ought to be turning green, not black or white. Be that as it may, if this is evolution, I believe in it. Variation within kind. Darwin was influenced by this very thing. Like many Englishmen, he was a pigeon fancier. The pigeons belonged to a group called the Columbiforms. There's over 300 species, the doves and pigeons. Most of them have been shown to be capable of interbreeding, and they show the incredible variety you see in this picture. The one down in the lower left doesn't look like a dove or a pigeon. It looks like a turkey. And one is puffing up its neck with its cervical air sacs. They not only look different anatomically, there are behavioral differences among doves and pigeons. For example, you have homers, you have tumblers. Just as you see in dogs, you get certain behavioral differences. So yes, there is variation within kind. God said he created kinds. The Hebrew word is men, and we know that men means all creatures capable of interbreeding, because at the time of the flood, God brought to the ark at least two of each men, and we can assume they were breeding pairs. So do dogs change? Oh my goodness, if you're familiar with all the varieties of dogs out there, dogs do change, but they change into what? Different dogs. In fact, it's not only dogs that can interbreed, Canis familiaris, but they can breed with other species. The wolf, Canis lupus, the coyote, Canis latrans. They're all capable of interbreeding and producing viable offspring. Now, do wolves and dogs normally interbreed? No. I get out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming every once in a while. I see the wolves out there. And when a pack of wolves sees dogs, they're not thinking of puppies. They're thinking of food. But they can and do interbreed. And it's incredible the kind of variation we can get within kind. And once human beings start deciding what they like in the appearance of a dog, there's absolutely no accounting for personal opinion and preference. I mean, for example, is this dog necessary? That's a question I have for you. This is a Chinese crested. I've made fun of this dog so long that I'm starting to become attached to him, actually. I just think that's the cutest little pink belly I've ever seen. People say, you know, if you don't want a Chinese crested, I mean, what kind of dog do you want? I say, I've always wanted a bird dog. My whole life I've wanted a bird dog. They say, why don't you get a bird dog? Get a black lab. They're a great bird dog. And I said, a bird dog, you know, one that can fly. Why can't I get a dog with wings and feathers that flies? The answer is so simple, I'm embarrassed to share it with you. There are no genes for feathers and flight and bird beaks and what have you in the gene pool of the species Canis familiaris, as simple as that. Natural selection cannot select for something that is not already there to be selected from. I mean, if you're of an experimental bent, here's something you could do. Go down to your friendly Midas muffler dealer and order a dozen yellow roses. Will you get them? No, why not? They don't stock them. But what if you forgot your wedding anniversary and you really need them? Then would they have them? No, you see, need has nothing to do with it. And remember that about evolution and natural selection. Need has nothing to do with anything. You can only select what's already there. In fact, here's a conclusion I've come to on natural selection. Natural selection is a count of the differences that we see. It explains, not explains, but shows us the survival of the fittest, okay? Natural selection tells us nothing about the arrival of the fittest. That's what evolution needs to do. And what about this thing called microevolution, the little steps that evolutionists and creationists agree on? We agree dogs vary. We don't, as creationists, like the word microevolution because it sort of implies that macroevolution is microevolution writ large. We just prefer simple variation, which is observed. It's not a theory, it's an observation. Roger Lewin, writing in Science Magazine on a meeting that was held several years ago at the Wistar Institute, a group of evolutionists got together to just debate this whole issue. Does this microevolution, does this variation we can actually see, is that related to macroevolution, the amoeba to man type of evolution? The conclusion was this: the central question of the Chicago conference was whether the mechanism of microevolution could be extrapolated to explain the mechanism of macroevolution. He says the answer can be given as what? A clear no, and the capital N was in the original. Well, let's wrap down to the next category. Creationists say when you look at the fossil record, creatures appear suddenly and fully formed. Evolutionists say, no, the fossil record is a record of progress, while you can just see one forming the next. Ever look at some of these charts for a whole group of creatures? Like, look at the dinosaur family tree. By the way, notice they include the birds in there. The birds are now classified under the clade Dinosauria, so they're not extinct. They're feeding in your bird feeders even as we speak. And yet evolutionists still get upset when you say humans and dinosaurs live together at the same time on Earth. Hey, humans and blue jays live at the same time, but birds are dinosaurs. It's a moot point. We're just talking what species now.
Dr. David Menton is making the case for creation. When we come back, he's going to talk about the degree to which evolution depends on sheer speculation. He's Speaker for Answers in Genesis and Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis. From the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Dr. David Menton making the case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Brian Wolfmiller has written a column for the latest Lutheran Witness magazine titled You Will Have Trouble. It's one of several articles on the theme of Christian persecution in the May Lutheran Witness. Check it out at cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness. You can receive 6 issues for only $6.99. cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness. He introduced it before the break, but here's Dr. David Menton from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference talking about evolution's dependence on speculation.
But notice the yellow lines merely show that we think we see the first dinosaurs at this level of the geological column, and we continue to see them up to the current level of the geological column. Where the information would be is in the gray zone, that is in the branches between the columns, and that's all speculation. The evolution part is speculation. The picture looks very similar for the mammalian family tree. Look at all the dotted lines. All we're told is that mammals exist, and they are believed to have existed over a certain period of time. And by the way, that period of time gets longer and longer as they continue to find specimens in what evolutionists consider to be earlier and earlier rocks. And then we have the living fossils. These are fossils that aren't alive, but they're fossils of creatures and plants that are very much alive and with us today in what appears to be essentially identical or extremely similar configurations. Here you see what evolutionists would call a 60-million-year-old walnut. It may be familiar to you. There is a 60-million-year-old acorn. And I love the 25-million-year-old oak leaf. There's more variation among the individual leaves of any given oak leaf tree than there is between any living oak leaf and this one. But they're never going to give the same scientific name to something in the fossil record that exists today. So today the oak is what, Quercus or something like that. They're going to give it a different name in the fossil record. Here is what evolutionists consider to be a 60-million-year-old bat. Now I believe God created everything about 6,000 years ago. And that's based on the genealogies of Scripture. They're daisy chained. We know how old one person was when the next person was born. Someone says, yeah, but maybe one or two got left out. Well, there you go. There's your 4.5 billion years right there. This bat not only looks, for all practical purposes, like a modern bat, it even has these grooves in the skull, which make a bat look so frightening, that are used to channel sound for sonar navigation. I got news for you. There are no pre-bats. It's almost as if bats came into being suddenly. And a bat is an interesting creature. I mean, its fingers have become so long that if it couldn't fly with them, I don't know anything else it could do with them during the time they were getting longer. The pelvis is unrotated in a bat. And our pelvis is rotated 90 degrees one way from when we were an embryo in the womb, and our arms rotated 90 degrees the other way. That's why our legs are on backwards. You want to do an experiment? Flex your arm, flex your leg. Do you notice that they're backwards? They're 180 degrees out of phase. If you wonder what life would be like if that didn't happen, check out the bat, unrotated pelvis. Here comes a shocker for you. Here's what evolutionists would call a 135-million-year-old ant. Do you see anything here you recognize at all? Now, my favorite is a horseshoe crab. I went to school in New England at Brown, and we had a lot of horseshoe crabs running along the New England beaches. They're alive and well today. Now, this is a fossil of a 160-million-year-old horseshoe crab next to a modern horseshoe crab. For all practical purposes, they are the same creature. Could there be little minor things in the appearance? Possibly, but now, the thing that's intriguing is how long ago do evolutionists think horseshoe crabs evolved? About 500 million years ago. How long ago did they think dinosaurs evolved? Depending on who you believe, 150 to 200 million years ago. You realize what that means? Dinosaurs are Johnny-come-latelys to evolutionists compared to horseshoe crabs. Yet they're still running the beaches today. As a creationist, I don't even believe it's possible to have something be that stable for 500 million years. And yet that's the fossil record. Also, the fossil record shows evidence of rapid formation. You can't make a fossil slowly. Here's a fish eating a fish. It didn't even get its supper down. On average, how many million years does it take one fish to horse down another? By the way, we've got a fossilized fish eating a fish at the Creation Museum. It's a different fossil than this, and this fish is also swallowing its food head first. Who taught them that? If you swallow it tail first just once, the party's over. It's going to get stuck in the neck. I wonder how many million years it took of swallowing the fish backwards until they finally got around to seeing, no, get it the front way. And by the way, you're not looking at bones here, you're looking at the flesh. The flesh is not rotted yet. In fact, our fossil in the Creation Museum has one area that's black on the whole fossil, and that's the eye. You're still seeing evidence of the visual pigments in the fossil. This means the fossil was formed quickly. So when you see fossils in sedimentary rock, that sediment has been deposited very quickly, and it contained a cementitious material that allowed it to set up that produced this fossil. If it doesn't set up, it remains soft, the fossil will probably break down or disaggregate. You say, do rocks form that fast today? Yeah, it's called concrete or cement. It's a natural product. If you have enough of it in the sediment, you get a good fossil-forming area. So when you look at fossils, the fossils themselves did not take a long time to form. They had to form quickly, and the whole layer you find them in had to form quickly. So where is the time between, say, four layers that you see along the side of the road? It's not in the layer, it's between the layers. And what do you see between the layers if you pry them apart? Nothing. The age is where there's nothing. It's inferred. So that the lowest layer was the top of the earth for a million years, and then it was covered. The next layer was the top for a million, then the next layer. Thing that's interesting is, why is it today all of the scratches and gouges, all of the canyons, all the meteoritic impact sites, all the caverns are in our layer? You don't see anything that appears to have begun in the layers underneath that had their own canyons and their own meteoritic impact sites. It almost looks as if the layer we're on today is the one that's been there pretty much all along. And then there's this data that's emerging. This is starting getting close to home. I have a fossil I'm looking at right now. This is from the work of Mary Schweitzer. It's a T-Rex that they dug out of the, was it Montana, a few years ago. And when they looked inside the femur, it happened to be broken. They had to break it to get it out of the rock. She saw what appeared to be marrow, and it was still relatively soft. She then softened this partly permineralized fossil with a weak acid or a chelating agent and looked at it under the microscope. And there she found what appeared to be red blood cells with nuclei, which you would expect in a reptile. They find evidence of osteocytes, the bone cells in the lacunae, complete with nuclei. They find blood vessels, as you see in the picture on the right, capillaries that are branching and elastic. I had a rancher come in from Lemon, South Dakota, just about a couple of weeks ago. He asked me if I wanted some fossils. I said, sure. Here are their duckbill dinosaur fossils. He had a truck bed full of them. And I noticed one was a tibia, it was broken open. And even as a creationist, I looked at it and thought, I'm not seeing what I'm seeing. Instead of being filled with mud, the inside there looked like it was filled with marrow, and it looked like three vascular channels running through it, like nutrient arteries go through the center of the bone. Even now, I'm working on this specimen, and we're looking at it in the microscope, and the preliminary evidence is that we will have cells with nuclei. Imagine it, 65 million years, and we have branching capillaries, we have osteocytes in their lacunae with processes, we have red blood cells, we find measurable evidences of collagen and other proteins and molecules. What do the evolutionists say? Oh, this shows us a new form of fossilization we didn't know about. Others denied that this could even be true. They said they don't care how good the evidence is. They're not going to accept any of this as having anything to do with biological material. That's how deeply ingrained the evolutionary view is. Well, I could go on for millions of years and that kind of thing, but here's one that's pretty obvious to us. Creationists say mutations are harmful. I ought to know, I've had a few. They're called cancer, so has my wife. Evolutionists say, well, okay, so mutations may be harmful, but over the long haul are beneficial. In fact, they've got us where we are today. Well, nothing's been mutated much more than these poor fruit flies. Countless generations of fruit flies have endured mutation, more generations than there could ever have been humans on Earth, no matter how old you think humans are. And we produce blind fruit flies. We produce fruit flies with no eyes, but nobody has ever produced a viable, improved fruit fly with mutations induced by radiation. In fact, a distinguished geneticist by the name of Moto Kimura has studied over the last several years negative versus positive mutations and whether selection can select for these. Notice that in this chart, zero would be a neutral mutation that is neither good or bad. To the left are negative mutations. The very, very negative ones are close to the far left. The ones that are almost neutral are near the middle. Notice his curve doesn't get to the middle because he doesn't know of any mutation that is not at least slightly deleterious. Notice nothing is shown on the positive side because he doesn't know of anything to put over there.
Dr. David Menton's Making the Case for Creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 10th. We'll hear the remainder of his presentation on the other side of the break. Then later in hour two, Mark Hemingway joins us, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. We'll talk about President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and the House passage of a health care bill, especially how it relates to the funding of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Danny Faulkner will join us to talk about the Vatican, affirming both creation and the Big Bang. Stay tuned for hour two.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muscoota, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuscoota.com.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Dr. David Menton of Washington University make the case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. We've got a new Issues Etc. book of the month. It's called From Atheism to Christianity, the story of C.S. Lewis, written by Issues Etc. regular guest Joel Heck, tells the story of, well, one of the most famous atheists who became one of the 20th century's most famous Christians, and not just a Christian, but an apologist for Christianity. That doesn't mean he apologized. It means he was a defender of the faith, as well as a talented writer in his own right. From Atheism to Christianity, the story of C.S. Lewis is the Issues Etc. book of the month for May. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. It's on every page of the website, or call Concordia Publishing House and order From Atheism to Christianity. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. We're hearing Dr. David Menton of Washington University make the case for creation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Back to his presentation, he was speaking before about a study done by a geneticist, Moto Kimura, and what he found by way of genetic mutation.
But the really interesting part of his study is what he called a no-selection zone, and that is these weakly negative mutations wouldn't be picked up by natural selection. They would just accumulate in the population. And indeed they have. Since the days of Adam and Eve, we've been accumulating mutations. It's called the genetic load. It's why today we can't have brother, sister, or even first cousin interbreeding, whereas Adam and Eve's children obviously would have to have married one another. It wouldn't have been a genetic problem back then because they had no genetic load whatever. The forbidding to marry that close came later. Even if there was a good mutation, it would be very slight and it would fall in the no selection zone. Back to our chart, Creationists say evolution is improbable. Evolutionists say it's not only probable, it's inevitable. I'm not even going to talk about how probable is, say, the origin of the human brain. We have 100,000 different proteins in our body. Did you know that? 100,000 different ones, most of which are absolutely essential for life. And one of those, any one of those, is made up of about 500 amino acids on average. Amino acids are the subunits, like beads in a string. And if we were to call these amino acids, rather than by their tongue twister name, if we were to just give them the letters A through T in different colors, we could produce one of these little alphabet strings of beads. And think of it, if you're trying to make a string of beads 500 long, and you had 20 different colors to work with 20 different letters of the alphabet, how many strings of beads could you make that differ by at least one bead? The answer's lots. Let's consider a protein you're all familiar with, hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is necessary to bind oxygen. Blood is warm, right? You ever drink water that's as warm as blood? It tastes flat. The reason it tastes flat is there's almost no oxygen in it. You can't get oxygen to dissolve in water that temperature. So how can we possibly expect warm blood to carry oxygen from our lung down to our big toe? You can thank hemoglobin. By the way, once you get there, you got to get it to let go, and that's another whole issue we won't even get into. But you need hemoglobin, and human hemoglobin is a very long, 539 amino acids long. If you started out with all the right proportions of the amino acids in human hemoglobin, and there's only one adult hemoglobin that functions normally, it's been shown that if you start with all the right proportions, you had the right number of A's, B's, C's, and D's, the total number of ways of putting these together is 4 times 10 to the 619th power. That would be a 4 with 619 zeros after it. That's how many different ways you could put it together, of which only one is known to function normally in the adult, and there's four other specialized ones with a higher affinity for oxygen that function in the developing fetus. How big a number is this? Well, if you just looked at the first 80 zeros, which is such a pittance, it doesn't even compare to the whole number. That would be approximately the number of atoms estimated to exist in the known universe. And if you add one more zero, it's 10 times bigger. Let's add a bunch of them, 150. I'm not going to go beyond this. It gets ridiculous. 150 zeros after the four. Is a number that's called a universal probability bound. Statisticians say that if the chance of something happening is worse than one out of this, the opposite is a certainty. They warn you not to play games of invoking endless time to make the improbable probable. It undermines the entire statistical foundation of modern science. I don't know how to tell you how big this number is. I'll just give it one last stab to give you a little help in understanding the size of this number. This whole number is so big, it's actually bigger than the current American national debt in dollars. How about that? I said current. We got another year and a half or so to go. Okay, another difference. Creationists say evolution is unessential. Nobody needs it. It contributes nothing to empirical science. Evolutionists say it's absolutely essential. You can't do science without it. Our country's doomed if we don't all believe it. Well, a lot of this idea comes from what's been called Dobzhansky's mantra. He was a leading 20th century evolutionist, and he's famous and oft quoted for saying, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." That's why we have to teach it everywhere. Is this true? Here's an evolutionist, Adam Wilkins, publishing BioEssays, Volume 22, in December 2000. He said about evolution that it's superfluous. He said the subject of evolution occupies a special and paradoxical place within biology as a whole. While the great majority of biologists would agree with Dobzhansky that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, most can do their work quite happily without particular reference to evolutionary ideas. I like this point. He says, evolution would appear to be the indispensable unifying idea and at the same time, what? A highly superfluous one. In case this isn't a clincher for you, how about one more here? This is Dr. Mark Kirshner. He's one of the leading evolutionists in the country. He's on the cutting edge of looking for things besides natural selection that might explain evolution. He is head of systems biology at Harvard. Publishing in the Boston Globe in October 2005, he said this about evolution and its importance to science. He says, in fact, over the last 100 years, almost all of biology has proceeded independent of evolution, except evolutionary biology itself. So if you're going to teach evolution, you need it. Apart from that, he looks at his own field of expertise and says, molecular biology, biochemistry, and physiology have not taken evolution into account at all. When I taught in the medical school, I was ahead of a course called histology, looking at the microscope to the human body. And there were several faculty teaching in the course, and some of them would talk briefly about evolution, just a few seconds. I called it a confession of faith. And whenever they did this, the students taking notes would set their pencils down, kick back, and relax. And when they got back to talking about the kidney or whatever they were talking about, up would come the pencils and away they would go. Now, the students were being disrespectful. They almost all believed in evolution. But when a prof started speculating on evolution in the middle of a lecture, say, on the kidney, they knew two things about this speculation. Number one, no way is it going to be on the exam, and it never was. And two, they knew they would never use it in the practice of medicine. I know we have some physicians here today, and I'm sure you can attest it plays absolutely no role whatever. Well, back to our chart. Boy, here's something really basic. Either God is eternal or nature is eternal. And whatever is eternal is your God. We got a current version of Cosmos going right now. You probably have seen it in television. You may not know it wasn't the first one. Back when my children were growing up, Carl Sagan had his own series. I think it was 10 or 12 hour presentations on television, and the school that my children went to laboriously went through all the hours in the classroom. And during this presentation, Carl Sagan says the cosmos is all there is, or was, or ever will be. If God is eternal, God is your God. But for Carl Sagan, nature is his God. Well, finally, I'm going to talk about where the rubber hits the road. This is the important part. Death is the result of sin, according to creationists. That's how sin, death came into the world, pain, suffering, and death. To evolution, get this, this is key, death is natural. It's always been here, it's here now, and it'll always be here as long as there's any life. You can't have life without death. Let's look at that. Back again to our friend Carl Sagan. He said this about death. Any other evolutionists say the same thing. He said, the secrets of evolution are time and death. Time for the slow accumulation of favorable mutations and death to make room for new species. You see, death has been called the engine of evolution. It's what makes it run. You can't have evolution without death, and to evolution, death has always been here. I mean, what do you see when you look at the fossil record? Billions of dead things buried in rock layers, deposited by water all over the earth. You'd almost think there was a global flood, wouldn't you? And how dead are these fossils? Man alive, they're stone dead. This is my favorite fossil illustrating death. This is a saber-toothed tiger munching through some other animal's femur. That had to smart, I'm telling you. Right through the femur. So the fossil record is a record of death. Think of it. You stand on the edge of Grand Canyon and you expect to see fossils, and it turns out there really are no fossils of vertebrates in the whole of Grand Canyon. Everything in Grand Canyon is an invertebrate. There are a lot of vertebrate footprints, but no vertebrate fossils of feet. That would suggest that footprints evolved several million years before feet. But some people look at the fossil record, Christians, and say, why, that is a record of God's creative work over time. Others look at that same fossil record and say, that is a record of God's judgment for sin. These are creatures destroyed in that flood. Wow, that's two very, very different worldviews. These two people are never going to be on the same page. Just look at this. Reflecting on Genesis 1:31, how God called everything that he had created when he finished in the sixth day. He called the whole of it perfect. And here we have Adam and Eve in the garden, and Eve is saying to Adam, "Oh, Adam, this is such a perfect world." And Adam is saying, "Yes, Eve, it's very good, just like God said." And then they show this Garden of Eden resting on millions of years of bones, millions of years of pain, death, killing, disease, struggle, suffering, and extinction. Does this make any sense? Let's just compare the two again. Evolutionists say that life evolved very, very simply. Some little primordial ooze, slime molds, blue-green algae, whatever. And then slowly over the years, through countless suffering, disease, and death, we slowly work our way up to man. No wonder some people set at their standards, kneel at the grave of a dead spouse, as I did several years ago now. And some of them say, "Some God of love you are. Why did you do this?" If God is the author of death, because he created everything by the mechanism of death, well, we might sit by the grave and say this. But that's not what Scripture tells us. It said God made us perfect. We wouldn't have died, indeed, had we been obedient, not eaten of the certain tree. Our artist wanted to show the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They didn't know how to paint it because we don't know what fruit it was. So they painted it to look like a hand grenade. They figured that was as good as anything. And from this initial perfection, the fall came in the world, and we have come downhill to where we are today with pain, suffering, and death. And when you understand that, when you're by the grave, you can say, "Oh, wretched man that I am, Lord, forgive me this mess. It's because of my sin." My sin going back to that first sin of Adam. Because the Bible says in Romans 5:12, "Whereas by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for all have sinned." How are we doing on time? I need to finish up, what, August? what is it? Is it 3:10? 3:11? So we're almost done. I want to conclude by saying death is our enemy. Death is not our friend. There are theistic evolutionists who say, we look negatively on death. We shouldn't look negatively on death. After all, death has always been with us. It's been here from the beginning. It's God's provisions for us. Believe me, the Bible doesn't say death is natural. And it doesn't say death is a friend. In 1 Corinthians 15:25, verse 26, it's one of the things that got me through losing a wife at the age of 48. And that is, Jesus must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that will be destroyed is death. Jesus must reign until he's put all enemies under his feet. Well, I don't know, we probably don't have time to get into the compatibility of Christianity with evolution, but it should be obvious by what I said, by what we've covered thus far. There's no real compatibility here. You know what one of the problems is? If you believe in chemistry, are you a chemist? In fact, would anybody ask you if you believe in chemistry? If you believe in physics, which nobody would ask you, but if you believe in physics, would you be a physicist? But if you believe in evolution, you're an evolutionist. Isn't that interesting? This is going to lead to some problems. It's going to allow every Tom, Dick, and Harry to come up with his own definition of evolution. One person says, "I believe in evolution," but God gets in and steers it like a truck down the road, left and right. I'll tell you, real evolutionists would go up the wall. They'll take a six-day creationist over someone like that. As a six-day creationist, I go up to evolutionists. They say, "I've got good news for you. My God has nothing to do with your evolution." They say, "Great. We don't want any help from your God." You know, if evolution involved divine intervention, you couldn't teach it in our public schools. The courts have decided that things that involve divine intervention can't be taught as science, at least. The day evolution takes on divine intervention as part of its mechanism is the day evolution's going to be out looking in through the window with the creationists. To evolution, it's crass materialism. And while Christians today may be able to embrace evolution and somehow in their mind still recognize that they are sinful, they have a savior, I'm not going to judge their eternal welfare. That's between them and God. I'm not the gatekeeper. But I am going to tell you this. You may be able to keep your faith intact, but will your students that you teach, will the members of your congregation keep their faith intact? If you teach that death is natural, it's been here from the get-go, that there was no literal Adam, that Adam wasn't the first one to sin and wasn't the first to die among humans. And if you undermine the first Adam, what becomes of the second Adam, who's equated with the first Adam? It all falls. I pray that won't happen to us here, and I pray that won't happen in our synods, but I see bad things going on. All I can say is keep your eyes on things going on right now. A couple of years ago, I attended American Association for the Advancement of Science that met in St. Louis, and they were really distressed by the idea that over 40% of Americans continue to believe in fiat creation in about 6,000 years. And they said the reason for this, and it's not like this anywhere else in the world, they insisted, the reason it's like this in America is because of Christianity. Conservative Christianity's indoctrinated all these students to believe in a creator, that God created by the power of his word. They said, the only way we're going to win this battle is we need to get into the church. And the AAAS got together with the Templeton Foundation that greased the skids with money, and they've gone to now 10 different seminary schools, 20 applied for the money, 10 got it, and for about $200,000 in money, these SEM schools are going to allow evolutionists to come into the regular religion classroom and teach evolution. Kind of wonder what they could have bought for $500,000, huh? One of those, as I understand, is Concordia Seminary in St. Louis that has accepted this money, and I presume we'll get local evolutionists, possibly from Washington University. They may be talking about other things besides evolution, possibly global climate change and man's responsibility for it, or conservation, what have you. Maybe not everything they teach will be something inappropriate, but it's something you need to watch. Thank you very kindly for your attention.
That's Dr. David Menton's presentation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Making the Case for Creation. When we come back, Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard joins us to talk about President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and the House passage of a health care bill. Stay tuned.
People are talking about the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Lutheran FCU was created solely to serve LCMS workers, families, and entities, and proceeds benefit LCMS organizations. Lutheran FCU offers deposit accounts and loans and has service access at thousands of branches and ATMs nationwide. Lutheran FCU also offers members Christian-based lending advice for new loans and refinancing, minimal account fees, and superior personalized service. Check them out at LutheranFCU.org.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A confessional liturgical Lutheran congregation in southeast Michigan in Rochester Hills. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. That's LCIW.org. We gather for the divine service every Sunday, 9:30 a.m. at Lutheran High School Northwest. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. Find us on the internet at lciw.org.
The number of recent Christian martyrs is staggering. 90,000 Christians are estimated to have died for the faith in the past year alone. Wondering what to think and how to prepare to endure persecution yourself? Check out Mays, the Lutheran Witness, for insight on memorizing the scriptures, learning from the early church martyrs, and looking to Christ on the cross for comfort. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.